Welcome back to our series In Conversation With. We're exploring the lives and careers of people across Elgium to understand more about what brought them to asset management. This podcast is intended for investment professionals. So I'm joined today by co-head of Pan-European Investment Grade Research, Madeline King. Madeline, thanks so much for being here.
You're very welcome.
Now, the first question I've got to ask is, that title is huge.
It's a ridiculous title. It barely fits on a business card.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, how big are your business cards?
Well, I use a small font. That's the secret.
Oh, God, yeah. See, copywriters everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Know the tricks. So how would you explain this massive title of a role that you've got?
Well, I would say ignore the title. Yep. Just focus on the word research. That's okay. Probably the important one. The other words are just, unnecessary. They're just business card fillers.
Okay. So
I work in the research team.
Okay.
For fixed income, so bonds.
Yep.
And it's my team. My team's job is basically to research the companies that we invest in. So we're all sector specialists, and we all know the companies that we buy the bonds of inside out.
Yep.
So kind of a simple way to describe my job is I decide whether or not we should buy Vodafone bonds. That's how I describe it to my mum's friends, anyway.
To your mum's friends.
Yeah.
I think that's a very nice way of putting it. I imagine when we say research, there's a hell of a lot of reading. Are you diving into these companies' annual reports? Have I understood that right?
Yeah, there is definitely a lot of reading involved, a lot of kind of, let me get to know this sector, this company. Yep. There's a lot of data. I think this industry has changed from when I first started in the role, it was, let me try and find out as much as I possibly can about this company and this sector. And now you're almost like drowning in information, and it's more about sifting through it all and figuring out what's important and what's going to make the difference to our investments.
So how do you decide what's a good source of data? Like, how do you filter the noise of information that I imagine you must receive about, say, Vodafone, one of the biggest telecoms companies in the world?
It's really hard, to be honest, and it's just a judgment thing.
Yep.
And you kind of can't teach it straight away. So when we get new people starting on the team, it's the hardest part of the job to kind of explain and articulate. Yeah. And it's just judgment, and it comes with time, to be honest.
I imagine it's a lot of kind of someone, a young grad saying, I found this amazing stat that no one else has seen. And the answer is, unfortunately,
Sorry, that's really boring. We already knew that.
Yeah,
there's a lot of that.
Oh, the crestfallen face of that poor grad.
Yeah.
So what made you decide that you wanted to go into research, as in even asset management to begin with?
It was kind of an accident, to be honest.
I think that's kind of been the theme of all of our In Conversation With series.
I don't think anyone sort of grows up and it's like, I must be co-head of Pan-European Investment Grade Research when I grow up.
What a terrible meeting that would be with a careers guidance
counsellor,
you, sir, are very suited to
Pan-European Investment Grade Research.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm from Lancashire originally, and we don't really have investment management there or investment banks. So I didn't in any way have any clue what finance was growing up. But then went to university and sort of kind of fell into like careers fairs and stuff, and Goldman Sachs sponsored my netball team, so I had to go to a women in finance event, and they sort of lured me in that way. That was kind of my first introduction to finance.
What did you study at university?
Maths and economics.
Maths and economics.
Yeah.
So quite well suited to when this opportunity comes about that, it appealed to, at least I assume you enjoyed university.
I did. Super nerd. Loved the maths. Thought the economics would be a good, like, surely that'll get me a job at the end of it. That was kind of my logic.
That's a very good way of reasoning it out in only a true logician kind of way.
Yeah.
So I'm right to understand that you started then at Goldman?
No, it was just Goldman who kind of explained what investment banking was to me at this netball sponsored event. And then I ended up applying to all the investment banks.
Okay.
Started off on the grad program at Barclays Capital, as it was called at the time. And then I worked at a few different investment banks and then joined asset management at Elgium in 4 years ago.
Four years ago.
Yeah.
So what, as you've progressed through your career, from that grad scheme to now, you must have made a lot of decisions to specialise both in fixed income and then within that on the research side. How did that come about?
Also by accident. My first rotation was in fixed income research, mm-hmm. and then Barclays stopped doing the rotations. So it was like musical chairs, it's and not, the music stopped yes, immediately.
Music hasn't even started.
Yeah,
at that
exactly.
point.
They turned it on very briefly and switched it off straight away. But it just so happened that I'd landed in a seat that I really liked. Yeah. I just was like, this is good.
Yeah.
Carried on and sort of did lots of different versions of the same role over the years.
Mm-hmm. And how have you seen, so having been in research for most of your career, or all of your career, sorry, then how have you seen the way that that's changed? You mentioned how the finding sources of usable, very applicable data has become more difficult. Are there other ways that you've really seen the approach to research differ from 5-10 years ago?
I think I have definitely not making the move from investment banking to investment management definitely mm-hmm. was a shift in yeah. a way that I always find quite difficult to describe, because yeah. in a way it's exactly the same job. You're looking at the same companies, yeah. you're sort of having the same conversations with fund managers instead of with traders, but it's very, very similar. But I guess the big picture of what you're doing is fundamentally different. You're kind of mm-hmm. safeguarding this massive amount of money yeah. Rather than trying to encourage people to trade with you. So it is kind of a different nuance. And so the just asset management in general has, mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of complexity to it that I just hadn't appreciated until I joined.
Time.
Yeah. I think I've been here long enough that I'm not allowed to say I'm new to the asset management industry anymore, because it's not really true.
What do you think the cutoff point is that is? Like 2 years, 3 years, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm stretching it now. Yeah. I think about three years in, somebody said to me, you're not new to asset management.
Yeah,
at
you
all.
Are now
That's
very well established yes. in the world of asset management yeah. and all that entails about yeah. pension safeguarding and mm. everything like that. Let's dive in a little bit more about how your work in the research team really feeds into the fund management. Let's dive into the world of asset management mm. and understand how, when you say, absolutely, we should be buying Vodafone's bonds, say, how does that feed into the world of our credit funds?
So we have lots of different credit funds, and they've all got slightly different investment parameters, mm. so different maturity preferences, different risk tolerances, yeah. different currencies, and so on. But my team works with all of those portfolio management groups. Mm. And essentially, our views on companies feeds into all of those portfolios. And mm. it could well be, I really like this company, but it's super high risk. So, and others are maybe like, do you know what? This is kind of a safe pair of hands. It's mm. not the most exciting investment opportunity out there, but it's going to be fine. I'm really happy to own it in this kind of stable yeah. fund. So it really depends. A lot of it is about understanding the nuances of the different funds and sort of what the risk preferences mm. are.
Would you say that a lot of your information is kind of fed into a database, or is it very much a face-to-face kind of, you've come to this decision, you've created this kind of conclusion from your data, and then you or your team would go and talk to the fund management system, or is it all quite centralized?
So we have a lot of like centralized data and mm. sort of here are our formal recommendations, but really talking to the fund managers is the important
it
part.
Makes most sense.
Yeah, like the last thing we would want is kind of I've written plus two in a spreadsheet somewhere and it feeds through and some trade automatically happens. Okay. I think you miss a lot of the nuances yeah. of understanding kind of the risk profile of an investment and how it fits into a portfolio.
I guess that comes back to quite a lot of the qualitative nature of your research of you can put plus two on a spreadsheet, but really that is so reductive for all of the work and all the understanding that goes into a company's bond, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's it. You do. I think any portfolio manager, they do want a nice, simple, like, do you like this or not?
Yes, exactly. Save my time, please.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yes or no, should I buy this? and of course, we do that. But mm. you do need a, well, I like this. and here's what could change my view. Like, here's why you might need to sell it. Here's what we need to look out for. This is when we, if it does work out well, then at what point should we be taking the position off? There's a lot of, it's not just kind of buy it and forget you hold it. You've got to kind of maintain it and understand the reason for the investment.
Creating a holistic understanding of the company, the bond and the environment, and of course, where it would apply to the fund, as you were saying. I'd like to just move on to a piece of work that I know you've done a lot of work on, which is related to this area, but which is the ESG active view. Now, ESG, environmental, social and governance, and the active view. I mean, so many people offer ESG scoring or quantitative measures. Can you tell us a little bit more about this active view, ESG and active? What's gone into that?
Well, I would say, so the background of this, first of all, is, I think we got quite lucky in a way. And this is obviously a massive focus for the industry now. Mm. And I think where we got lucky is we started looking at this kind of before anyone was really interested in it and before there was any pressure from clients. So we got to kind of do some experimentation, kind of what works and what doesn't, like what information is useful to us and what's a waste of time. Before there was this big pressure, and now it's paying off and everyone's massively interested in this subject. But the background was, as we were doing this research into what data do we have in the firm, kind of who's got the ESG opinions and how can we best use them, just realized kind of how much data we've bought, how many people do kind of some version of ESG, and just it was all really scattered around LGIM. So we have this great ESG team, but also lots of pockets of knowledge all across the firm. And so the active ESG view, as it's now called, it hasn't always been called that. It's had like 20 different...
Naming this thing is a beast in itself.
I don't even think that's the final name. I'm not quite sure. We sort of realized that there were all these pockets of value and we just wanted to bring them together into one place. So we've now built this overly techie database that then feeds into a tool that just allows analysts, so people in my team, anyone in the firm who wants to see it. So we put all the data that we've gathered and bought into this formal methodology of here's how we kind of weight what's important and what isn't. But then we have a mechanism in there to overlay our judgment. So if one of my team has met with the company, one of the equity team or corporate governance or potentially all of us at the same time, and we've discovered something that you're not going to see in a data point. The example I always use is we had an oil company in not that long ago where the chairman kind of gave the impression he didn't really believe in climate change. And that's something you're obviously not going to catch in a sort of data point.
No chairman's ever going to write in their annual report, by the way, global warming, maybe not.
That's not a field you can get from Bloomberg. Does chairman believe in climate change? But it is something that we felt was really valuable. So we can feed that in.
Imagine that you take that sort of information and that has implications for, is this company in the next 20 years when we're going to be using a lot less oil, are they going to be prepared for that? Maybe yes, but more likely no.
Exactly. So there's a lot of this judgment-based analysis that we do that we try and balance against kind of this wealth of data that we have. And then we also use this to work with the ESG corporate governance team to kind of feed into the engagement process. So if they're engaging with the company on a certain issue, they've got some background data that we've provided, or if we're going in to meet a company, it's really helpful if we know what they've been talking to them about over the last kind of couple of years. It's a simple example of there's a lot of companies currently in Europe where the corporate governance team are talking to them about splitting the chairman and CEO roles. Okay. And so they've kind of sent them these formal letters and started to have these conversations. And we think it's really useful if I'm having a meeting with someone in the company that I reinforce that message. And we think it's quite powerful where I think these companies are quite used to kind of getting letters from corporate governance teams. But what we're trying to do is kind of reinforce it. Mm. So every time they have a conversation with LGIM, they're getting the same consistent message about the themes that we think are important.
Oh, precisely. I imagine so many kind of big asset managers when in their dealings with asset management investors will deal with the fixed research analysts, and then they'll deal with the equity fund managers for the IR team, and then their chairman will deal with the corporate governance team.
Yeah, it can be very separate.
It's so many people having so many different conversations, but the power of linking up and, I think, speaking with one voice is... it just amplifies these kind of messages that I assume you're sending to companies that you want to help them become better and help improve our returns for our clients.
Exactly.
To take a bit of a hard left turn, how would you describe LGIM or even the asset management industry to friends, family? I mean, many people are unaware of what we do outside of a vague pensions notion.
I just describe it as looking after a big pile of money, basically. Yeah. It's the easiest way. Mm-hmm. I think... starting to go down the route of pensions, it's super boring. No one wants to hear about that. So massive pile of money. So the fixed income team has assets under management of about £165 billion, which is just a terrifying amount of money when you say it out loud. So, yeah, massive pile of money. That's how I would describe it.
Massive pile of money for people's pensions in the
massive
future.
Massive pile of money. Don't worry. We're taking great care of it for you.
All right. And to look ahead, we've talked about how the industry has changed. We've talked about how your role is conducted now. What do you think the future holds for both your role and asset management as a whole? Is it going to be still big piles of money in people's pensions?
I think it is, but I think there's always... I think of my job technically now is kind of the same job that I had as a graduate 15-plus years ago. But in reality, it's completely different because financial markets change. What drives asset prices changes, and the way we conduct research changes. I think a lot of that comes down to technology. And I think the way people tend to talk about it is almost too big picture in this, like, artificial intelligence. Are kind of robots going to be able to do my job? And everyone's like, no, a robot could not possibly do my job.
I am so much smarter. Yeah, how dare you impute
I am way better than a robot. but I think the reality is that the way technology changes the industry, it's in much smaller steps. And a lot of it is kind of technology that exists already. And it's just applying that more efficiently to how we do our jobs. And I think there's going to be more and more of that. Mm. I think there should be less, like, let me type something into a spreadsheet, and more, let me use my judgment, because that's really what we bring to the table over the robots.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you have as much machine learning, data regression, all of these terms, but ultimately when it spits out, here's the patterns that it's seeing, you can then apply your judgment and go, that looks about right, that looks right, or something's clearly gone wrong here as standing out as an anomaly.
Yeah.
So considering the job that you're currently doing, as you say, is so similar and yet so different to what you did in your graduate rotation scheme, what advice would you give to the Madeleine King grad?
So grad Madeleine King, I think the advice would be just kind of like not to overthink it, really. Yeah. I remember at the time feeling sort of pressure to like plan my career and, you know, this is my foot in the door, and then what does it lead to and what's the thing after that? And I had lots of plans to kind of do an MBA or do some other thing or move to some other, I can't even remember. But the reality is your job kind of changes anyway. It just, the market changes, everything progresses. Your career will take its own path. I didn't plan anything and it turned out fine.
Don't worry about it.
So really, it's all good.
Yes, exactly. Don't worry. It'll be all right.
Yeah.
Well, that's an amazing note to end on. Thank you so much for being here, Madeleine.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And be sure to listen next time for more of our In Conversation With series. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Mark Chappell, and see you again next week on LGIM Talks. Goodbye. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.